Welcome to the America Magazine podcast. America Magazine is the national Catholic weekly. Visit us online at www.americamagazine.org.
Hello and welcome to the America Magazine podcast, the week of August 31st through September 7th. I'm here with Karen Sue Smith, editorial director of America. Welcome, Karen.
I'm glad to be here. Thank you for inviting me.
Now, Karen is here to talk about an issue she's been blogging about for us for the last several weeks, which is healthcare reform. And we're at kind of at a crucial moment in the debate, so we thought we'd bring everyone up to speed. And we also have an editorial in this issue on this subject. So, Karen, maybe we can talk about this kind of stunning fact that's in this editorial, which is that in mid-June, the majority of Americans, according to polls, seem to be in favor of some kind of health reform. Now, 2 months later, and this is a much more polarizing topic, and it seems like there's a strong movement against it. What's happened in the last 2 months?
I think a lot of people would love to know exactly what's happened in the last couple months. And if you look at polls today, if you look at enough of them, and I really mean today and yesterday when some of the polls have come out trying to test public opinion, you'll find that even now public opinion is hard to pin down. Some of the polls basically show you that there is very little change, that the majority of people who have heard about these misinformation campaigns, for example, haven't really changed their mind. Others will show that there's been a decided shift. So what happened? A couple of things. One thing, and we mentioned this in the editorial, has to do with the economy. In the interim, while the healthcare bill has been being worked on, people have been watching the economy still going down. They've seen foreclosures still going up. They've seen jobs lost. And the fear quotient has increased. That's one thing. Given that that has happened, I think people have become more susceptible to any kind of misinformation, to doubt. And I think fear in some ways has taken over. And we can see the evidence of fear, not just anger, that's behind some of the misinformation that you see on television and in these town hall meetings.
In our editorial for this week, we talk about some of the obstacles to healthcare reform. Maybe you can lay those out for our listeners.
Well, what we tried to do in the editorial was to take a step back away from these shouting matches over the reform and to look at things from a longer viewpoint. We mentioned five obstacles that are not related to the legislation that's now going on in Congress, but that we think do influence it. And they influence it in this way, in the sense that they make the public less receptive to the reform. The obstacles are joblessness, foreclosures, economic instability, the fear of the future, those I just mentioned, and those are all related. They're not the same thing, but they're related. And then the last one is partisanship, and I would say instead of leadership, because what we're seeing now is concerted campaigns against the reform, even though the reform hasn't actually come out as real bills yet. We just have one from the House. That's all there is. The one from the Senate is still being discussed, and they won't even get back to talking about it in committee until mid-September. There are a lot of other obstacles we didn't mention in the editorial, and I don't know if you would like to hear about some of those, but I would add a small list or short list, and that is complexity is one, that healthcare is very complex, hard to understand. It involves enormous money, and that means interest groups as well. This is all about power, who's got it, who's wielding it. There's distrust of government. In fact, Andrew Kohut mentions that in one of his columns today. He talks about how different it is now than in the 1960s, the public attitude in the United States. And he asked the question, would Medicare, which is very popular right now, but would it even pass if it were on the drawing boards today? And he says he doesn't think it would.
Another subject that is also kind of a bit controversial is, who exactly are these uninsured? The number 48 million is the one that has been put out by the Obama administration, but some people have put out, say, well, how many of those are actually citizens versus undocumented immigrants? What can you tell us about those numbers?
Let me just give a prelude first, and that is that whatever census information we have right now, in other words, the reports that we now have are just about ready to become obsolete. And that's because a brand new report is expected out either the end of this month or the beginning of next month. And so whatever we know now, it only tells us about 2007. That's the most recent data we have. So when the new report comes out, it will only tell us about 2008. Here's what we know. The number that's been used most often is 46 million. 46 million people in the United States were uninsured in 2007. That's according to the U.S. Census Bureau. Notice, though, that it says people. That many people in the United States were uninsured. That's become a very important thing. And the reason is that some people want to make sure that their tax dollars are not going to be spent for a reform that will include anybody other than U.S. citizens. So then, if you look at the data, you'll find that not all of that 46 million are U.S. citizens. In fact, almost 36 million are citizens. The rest are just labeled as not citizens. So if people fault the president for saying 46 million Americans or citizens, they're technically correct that really it's closer to 36 million citizens. But people on the right who care so much about citizenship have also been making an error, and that is that they've been saying all the other people, that 10 million or so, are illegal aliens. Well, that's not true either. The fact that someone's not a citizen certainly doesn't mean that they're an illegal alien. They can be illegal. They can be legally here. They can be on their way to becoming a citizen. We don't know who they are. All we know is that they're non-citizens. That said, we could work out a kind of a profile of who the uninsured are. Most uninsured people live in the South. Most of them live in households where the household income, not the individual income, but the household income, is $50,000 a year or less. More than half of them, almost 27 million of them, worked during during 2007. And 21 million of those, in other words, almost all of them, worked full-time. So these are the people who are uninsured. They worked full-time, but they don't have insurance. They earn less than $50,000 a year in their household. Some people are surprised and chagrined to find out that not all uninsured people are poor or old or under age 18. And the two largest groups actually are between age 25 and 34, and 45 to 64, so they're highly employable ages. Some people are really upset when they look at that data from the Census Bureau and see that many of those households are not just above $50,000 in income, but $75,000 in household income. And they've somehow interpreted that to say, well, gee, those people could afford their own health care, which is possible in some cases, it's probable in some cases, but we don't really know from the data how big the households are, where they are, what the debt is that those families owe. We don't know all kinds of other things about them that could lead us to the conclusions that some people have drawn.
Turning to another controversial part of the healthcare initiative is this notion of a public option for healthcare. What can you tell us about, in general terms, what the public option would look like and why it's so controversial?
The public option may be controversial because of attitudes toward government and because it becomes susceptible almost immediately to the claims of big government or government takeovers. But in actual fact, the public option was just set up to be a nonprofit, government-run insurer, something that would be similar to Medicare, which is huge and well-liked by most of the people who are covered by it right now. What's important to me about the public option is that the doctors involved in it, the administrators, would not be working to achieve their maximum profit at all the time. That's really important because a nonprofit organization can make cuts and pay lower salaries sometimes. And if this public option were large enough, which a government-run agency is thought to be, then it could also negotiate prices with pharmaceutical companies and medical device makers and physicians, although there's some problem with that right now because of talk of a deal that's been made with the drug companies by the Obama administration, and then now by an amendment that's been placed on the House bill by Blue Dog Democrats. So I don't really know how that's going to all shake out. But the gist is that a public government-run plan would have lower overhead, lower marketing expenses, and that all would result in a lower cost, lower premiums than what you find with private insurers. That's important because a lot of the people who are not insured are poor, if not all of them are, many of them are, most of them are. And so the savings would provide incentives for private insurers too. Maybe they'd cut their premiums, or maybe they would have to appreciably increase their coverage or their services to compete. It was envisioned as an option. It's still envisioned as an option. No one would be forced into it, but it would be offered along with other choices. If there was an insurance exchange, which is what they've tried to work up, it would be one of those options. So you could choose it, but not everyone could choose it immediately. In fact, the public option would only be available to people with low incomes first, and then it might be opened up later on to people who earn higher wage. That actually is set up for two reasons. One, it would benefit the insurance companies, believe it or not, because then your employer, for example, wouldn't chuck the insurance that you currently have and rush over to get a lower premium option that's subsidized by the government. So that helps private insurers. But it also helps the government. And the reason it helps the government, and you can just read taxpayer whenever you hear the word government, is that according to the reform, anyone who could not actually afford to buy health insurance would be subsidized by the government. And so rather than subsidizing just private insurance, the government would be subsidizing itself in a sense. In other words, it would be recycling some of that money. And that makes more sense and would be a huge savings to taxpayers as well.
Yeah, that leads to the question is how we're going to finance what some people, the price tag they put on it is $1 trillion to expand healthcare to everyone. So what are the options for financing healthcare?
Yeah, that $1 trillion was the goal. And you remember that at first the Congressional Budget Office came out and said that the proposal was even more than that. It was $1.7 trillion. And so they've been trying to whittle it down to $1 trillion. But it's not $1 trillion all at once. It's $1 trillion over 10 years. Now, how would we pay for it? That's the golden question. And there are many means that will have to be employed to pay for it. The first one is obvious. It's taxes. One of the ideas was to let the Bush tax cuts for the wealthiest Americans expire when they're scheduled to and to not keep them on. That would raise some money. Another would be to impose some kind of consumer tax, almost like a sin tax. And one of the ones that's been proposed and discussed is a soft drink tax, because it's something that doesn't contribute to anybody's health and actually is a detriment. And so it's related to tobacco tax or alcohol tax that we have now. I proposed a sugar tax, and a couple other people have actually proposed something similar. Another idea was to tax insurance companies for the deluxe plans that they offer employers that are so far above basic coverage to add a premium on to those. And they assume, of course, that the companies would then pass that on to the people who buy the policies. But in any way, it would be a way to raise some money. So taxes, that's one. Another one, and this is a big one, though, has to do with Medicare. Even though Medicare has held down costs better than private insurance companies have on average and over many years, it still involves a lot of waste. And the government has been working to try to find out where that waste is, and even private physicians have been working to try to find out where the waste is, because what they've done is look carefully at it, and they've seen that in many places, very, very good health care is delivered for much less cost than in other places. And so when they've seen that, that gives them to believe that there's a lot of waste there, but also that there are models all around the country for ways to cut costs without cutting care. And so that's what they're going to try to do. They're going to try to tap what they have and what they're in control of, which is Medicare, and the bulk of financing would come there. One of the obvious things you've probably read about this is unnecessary testing or duplicative testing. And a lot of those tests are very, very expensive. They're CAT scans and not just x-rays, but MRIs. One study that I read said that if they could trim costs for Medicare down to the same dollar amounts that they're finding in these model places, and these model places have all different kinds of ways that they're arriving at this, they could trim $1,500 per patient per year. So if they can do that, even if they could do half that and then keep on trying it and do the half, another half, another year, this would be incredibly wonderful.
One question that might be worth addressing is what's working in our favor here? Obviously, there's so many challenges that we face in renovating healthcare. What is working to our advantage?
There are a few things that actually seem better than the last time, 16 years ago, when we tried this before under the Clinton administration. And that is that some insurance companies and the Association of Insurance Companies are on board. They're not opposing the president's plan or the idea of reform. Aetna, for example. And they have actually agreed, although there's no contract or anything, this is a verbal agreement, to plug up what I think are two of the worst parts about insurance right now, which is that you can be excluded from a policy if you have a pre-existing condition, and you can be dropped from a policy while the insurance company tries to prove that you had knowledge of a pre-existing condition or for other reasons, and both of those things would be overturned in a reform. Right now, some of the insurance companies have already said that they think, yes, they have agreed to go along with that. They've agreed to buy into that idea. So you have that. We have the AMA, the American Medical Association, on board. ARP is on board. You may have seen that there's been some action to try to come up with a more conservative ARP now, so some members are leaving. And apparently this happened last time. There was a stab at health care reform as well. Even some drug companies have signed on. You remember early on when the president met with a lot of drug companies, he tried to do what I think is a very smart thing, which is to not come at this with everyone as your enemy, but to try to have them be your friend. And he invited them to come and talk to him, and they talked together. And so a lot of the drug companies signed on up to a point. We also have people who, I mentioned this earlier, are trying to identify models that work. Some of that spade work has been done, and we can identify not just the Mayo Clinic or the Cleveland Clinic, but there's a whole list of model places that use different ways of cost cutting without cutting care. And so that's something that we already know about now and could begin to implement. We also have the success of however many years of Medicare, 40-some years of Medicare. So we know that the government can, in fact, run a health insurance plan because it runs Medicare, it runs Medicaid, the VA hospital. In fact, the government right now, this very moment, runs more than a third of all U.S. health care. So for people who are afraid of a government takeover, well, right now it's at a third, a little more than a third. I even think that the disinformation campaign has a kind of opportunity in it, which is that some people are saying, well, wait a minute. And this is a time when they're actually attuning their ear a little bit to the information. And so the other side of disinformation is if you can then get your message across, make it shorter, cleaner, clearer, sharper, whatever. And that takes time and practice. And I think that's an opportunity we have now. And finally, we have a lot of doctors, individual doctors, a lot of the public, all aware of the exploding costs in healthcare and determined to correct it. And I don't think that has changed. So I think those are some of the best things, some of the things that are really in favor of the reform.
Well, maybe we can end our discussion. We have some, you know, we have the facts now. We can look at the political situation briefly. Where are we in the process? The legislature is on vacation, but it seems like the Finance Committee in the Senate is playing a very large role here.
It is, and I'm not exactly sure why. Early on, it was because that was the bipartisan committee. Senate tends to play a magisterial sort of role vis-a-vis the House anyway, but the House bill and the people who support it represent much more of the United States population than the Senate committee does. We've reported this in the magazine earlier, that the number of people that are actually represented by the six members on the Senate Finance Committee bill that's working on health care, those six people, three Republicans, three Democrats, comes in at less than the population of New York City. It's less than 8 million people. In the House, you're talking about representatives from California, Pennsylvania, New York, Ohio, big population states, and they have passed their bill. It's still open for discussion, amendment, all kinds of other things. Then eventually the Senate will come up with its. They're supposed to reconvene September 15th. I don't know if that's still on or not. There was hopes that they would do something in the summer, but now that partisanship has kind of taken over, it looks like that won't happen. So they're not even going to get back together again until mid-September. Once they do produce a bill, a lot of people think this will be this will set the game plan. That remains to be seen. The next move is that there has to be what's called a conference bill. There has to be a compromise between the House and the Senate, and it's that bill that gets sent to the president either for his signature or not. So this is months away. We'll have months to discuss it, to learn what's actually in the bill, to try to separate fact from fiction, which there's an enormous amount of that that needs to happen, because one of the huge obstacles that I didn't get a chance to mention, but is that is public ignorance. And we've heard some very funny things that have been said, funny, but important, even by people who ought to know a lot better. So we're all going to have to brush up on healthcare and try to learn as much as we can about it, because we're all involved.
And a resource that our listeners can look to is our blog and all things, where Karen is blogging about this at least on a weekly basis, usually more than that. So you can just go to americanmagazine.org/things, and that'll bring you to those posts. We want to thank Karen again for joining us and for introducing us to this complex issue.
I hope it's helped.
I want to thank you for joining us for this week's edition of the American Magazine podcast. But you can look online for an archive of all of our articles on the healthcare reform debate. You can look just in our right-hand navigation bar under healthcare reform. Other online material includes an archive of articles on the Notre Dame controversy and Obama's appearance there in the spring, as well as reviews of A Show of Biblical Prints by Leo O'Donovan and a piece on work ministry. Reminder that you can respond to our podcast by going to americamagazine.podbean.com. This is Jim Reedy for America Magazine.